I mean, obviously I've done some research in between everything else that everyone has to do in the last couple of weeks, and I can honestly say I've read some weird stuff, weird stuff on what some sort of levels of feminism tends to be. I mean, one example of different sorts of feminism is cultural feminism. And by cultural feminism, what they basically mean is that women are naturally got different, talents or perceptions than that of men. They're kinder. They look at things in a better way. And to give an example of that, of course, many people will know that there's now a lot of women in the government of Iceland on the basis that they're going to really make sure that the economy is going to be nicer to people. And I looked up some of this. So it starts off anyway, cultural feminism, which is quite interesting. Basically, can women run an economy or a country better than men? Is that the problem? Is it the men themselves? And it says, Iceland's spectacular meltdown was caused by a banking and business culture that was buccaneering, reckless and overwhelmingly male. Women now running the country are going to have values of openness, fairness and social responsibility. And they argue that the economy is going to be incorporate feminine values. And one very powerful female business woman said, I'm sure Icelandic women will play an even bigger role now because the men are so spectacularly fucked up. That's basically it. The womanly and maternal qualities they bring to the boardroom. And I think we can all see that if you're going to run a company and make a lot of money and exploit a lot of people, you've got to be ruthless. I mean, that's capitalism based at the end of the day. But nevertheless, there is a thought that women will be able to run things differently. They'll be nicer bosses and they'll be fairer and everything. But of course, what that doesn't say anything about workers being organised and fighting for their own rights. You've just got to hope that women, and I mean, I'm sure all of us have worked for or with female bosses or people in that who are no different at all because they just act like a managers and what. The other issue was Sweden, where in April 2006 a group of prominent feminists set up Feminist Initiative, a women's party there. And that might be something that people might want to comment on as well. They demanded a six-hour working day, the right to full-time jobs, because a lot of women only do part-time work, the military service to be abolished, equal pay in force, and for more fathers to look after the children, because even though men and women in Sweden get 50-50, men and women get half, that. It's mostly women that take the time off with the children, but that's because they get paid less. So, again, it's an economic issue. However, at the party congress that took place soon after they set up, the congress agreed to abolish marriage and introduce a man tax to cover the cost to society of domestic, of all the things they've done to society, and that there should be gender-neutral names. And I've not heard much about that party since, but you can see that a group have decided to go, further. And that's, the whole idea of a cultural feminism. Now, another one, of course, we can't forget is theology, because there's a number of women in probably most of the religions in the world that actually believe that women should have a bigger role. They go back and look through either the Bible or the Quran or whatever the background to their religion is and point to places as women should be more. That's an area, obviously, that most of us probably aren't going to come in touch with, but nevertheless, you can see the way they're looking at it. And the separatist feminism, which is really saying that men are, cannot be changed at all. And if you like, the extreme example of that are women that believe that heterosexual relationships can't work, that because men have messed the world up, because men have abused women, violence against women, the oppression, etc., etc., that the only way the only person you can live with in a sexual way is another woman. And therefore, you should just completely forget about men or, get rid of the patriarchy and what have you. So that's quite, an extreme one. But it does exist, and then there are, you know, probably not masses of women that do think those ways. And to be honest, particularly perhaps women that have been badly abused and hurt by men, who probably feel that they can never, ever, you know, trust a relationship again. But many of the people that believe in this perhaps haven't, and, you know, just put this view over, as Tom has already said, this sort of anti-man sort of a situation. Then there's the question of black feminism, because of the fact that, you know, black people are oppressed already because of their colour and their race, and on top of that, they then have to fight, fight back against oppression the same as other women have to do as well. And another one, of course, is post-colonialism, which is basically saying that women from different countries are protesting that it's been imposed on them what rights they should and shouldn't have based on the rights in the West and that. And also the way that they should struggle has been imposed on them, and that, you know, many women in other countries have used different methods, different ways to struggle for women's rights. And then I'll just end by saying, of course, about the question of socialist feminists, which is what we would most likely call ourselves at the end of the day. And, of course, it goes way back, because if you look, a lot of the women that played key role in the Russian Revolution and around that time, such as the Kolontai, Luxembourg and Zetkin as well, they were and are still seen as socialist feminists, although some of the criticism against them is that they counterpose Marxism to feminism. And that's probably a criticism that's made a lot of socialists, that you might be feminist, but you're all out to change society, to get rid of capitalism and have socialism, and that's more important to you than actually fighting for women's rights, and therefore you're not really, you know, Marxism, socialism comes before sort of feminism, and I was hoping that we could discuss that a bit later. So that's just really some of the types of feminism that have been around. And I wanted to come back a bit later, perhaps, or if anybody else wants to raise it, on this question of socialist feminists, and, you know, what we're looking back historically on what's happened and what we need to do. So that's just a very quick background on the different types of feminism that there are. And I think definitely a lot of the issues that are raised here, I think we should all come back on later as well. And later on, what I wanted to do was to look into what's known as the three waves of feminism, going right back to the beginning of the 20th century, looking at the 60s and 70s, which was another milestone really in the development of women's rights, and looking at the situation in the 90s and now in terms of post-feminism. So I'll sort of come back to that a bit later when perhaps we've looked at some of the other questions. So.
Right.
Written. And in 1792, she wrote, which is a quote from the actual book she wrote. She ended one particular passage by saying, "Who can tell how many generations may be necessary to give vigour to the virtue and talents of the freed virgins, the freed virgin talents of the posterity of abject slaves?" And that was a sort of a summation, really, knowing that there'd be struggles ahead. I mean, a lot of the stuff she wrote was similar to the people you see on the costume dramas in terms of Emma and all those sort of ones on television, about women that aren't particularly badly off but are bored out of their minds, just sitting there looking out the window waiting for someone to gallop up to the main house or something, and how many things they can embroider before lunchtime. And she complains about that as a woman who was educated and had money. I mean, other women wouldn't have been able to write at that time. And a lot of her complaints were such that, you know, even women that were better off had a miserable existence, you know, that they had to act the idiot, if you like, act the sweet woman, try and get around men by being a bit sly and crafty and, you know, using their feminine wiles and all the rest of it. And she obviously, objected to that, but at least she was from a family that were radical and, you know, obviously would have supported her. The other one is Sojourner Truth, who started life out as a slave many years ago. She was born into slavery in 1795, obviously in the US, and became a free woman in 1827 and fought all her life for the abolition of slavery, but also for women's lives. And there's a brief speech that she actually made about what she was going through at the time and, you know, what she wanted to say. and she spoke to a mass audience, you know, in a language that perhaps, you know, we wouldn't use now. Well, children, when there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think that twixt the Negroes of the South and the women of the North, all talking about rights, the white men will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this, you know, to talk about? And she, you know, ends by obviously quoting religion, because, you know, people were very religious in those days, and she was religious as well. He says, the first women God ever made were strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone. These women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it back. And now they've asked them to do it, and men better let them. And it's just a sort of some small quotes by a woman that fought all her life. And one of the main things that she actually said in that speech is the terrible life that she left. She said, look at me, look at my arm. I've ploughed and planted, gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I've borne 13 children and then seen most of them all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but, you know, Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? And I think what she was saying is she's got the right to be a woman. Even though she's black, she's not inhuman. But also, of course, she fought for the rights of all women. And that really means that, you know, the struggle for women's rights goes way back before the 19th and 20th century. But one of the, some of the issues that they won in those days were property rights, you know, the right, again, it's better off women, obviously, the right to own your own house or what have you. Also rights over children, because if you were divorced, then the father had the right to keep the children, which I think is true in some other countries even now. And, of course, the most famous one was the right to vote. And although, as Lowe pointed out, I didn't see the thing on television last night, would have showed the suffragettes fighting for the right for women to actually vote. I don't know how much of they showed the suffragists in the sense of the working class women in the mills and what have you, that also fought very, very hard in much more difficult circumstances for the vote, and which even now aren't given the same sort of priority as the suffragettes themselves. And that wasn't just, of course, here. I mean, 1918, the votes were won for women that were 30 and had property, and by 1921, I think it was, around about 21-year-old women got the vote. But also in the United States as well, that they passed the 19th Amendment, which meant all women had a right to vote in all states. So, you know, you can see there's a lot of links between some of the struggles going on in the West at that time. But the background, I think Lois has mentioned this, was the struggle of women workers. And I just really wanted to give a few examples from some of the really magnificent struggles that took place around this time, which was the backdrop to a lot of women fighting back. And I have to wait 1 minute while I find... I think the first one, just an example, two examples from America itself, with huge influx of immigrants and huge numbers of immigrant women going to work in the factories. And in the book, The Rising of the Women by Meredith Tax, which I think some people here have read, describes some of the women struggles in the US. And in November 1909, then garment workers called a general strike of all these shirtwaist makers, that's what they're called, in New York, called the Uprising of the 30,000, or the Women's Movement Strike. Most of the strikers were teenage girls, and under the umbrella of the Women's Trade Union League, socialist strikers and society matrons, i.e. we're now getting to see women, again, who had money, who had a background in society and that, who helped them in that particular strike as well. And Clara Lemlich was the founder of this union. She led a walkout in her shop, beaten by hired thugs while picketing. They were opposing oppressive conditions at work, being followed to the toilets, I think that's coming back now, and hurried along. Fines, charges for electricity and thread and needle and everything like that. And complaints at the time as well that the male trade union leaders were not being militant enough, not fighting for them enough. They gained a wage increase, and they also gained the confidence of the the workers themselves got a lot of confidence. The other one was the Lawrence strike in Massachusetts, where the women workers there were given a pay cut of 30 cents a week and said that it was better to starve fighting than to starve working, effectively, which is a very good chart to have. 20,000 went on strike, and the famous poem or song, Bread and Roses, actually was written for that particular strike. The average spinner, female spinner, died at the age of 36. And it was very similar to the industrial period here in Britain at the time, where, you know, women were expected to have the baby one night and go back the next. So it was appalling conditions, but they fought back. And what they did is that the women and families in New York itself actually said that they would look after the children during the period of the strike. So they were sent to the women and families in New York, mostly trade unionists, mostly socialists, and those children were looked after during that period, but found many of them were malnourished, not from the strike, just because of the low wages and what have you. Picketing strikers were shot at by police, and one young girl striker was actually killed. But a quarter of a million workers in New England got the wage increase as a result of the strike. And there was a lot of support from middle-class feminists, which was invaluable, but it was also felt that they diluted the militancy somewhat of the workers, perhaps from the feeling that they couldn't really experience how you could be so poor and yet give up what little wages you've got, because not understanding that it was all or nothing for them and their futures and what have you, and that sometimes they were a huge help, but sometimes a bit of a drag on the movement as well. And the other side of it, of course, is the male trade unions, predominantly male, in the US and here, didn't want women workers because they were extremely worried that they were on lower pay, that they would, you know, lower the wage rate in industry. And to be honest, women have had to fight, socialist women in general have had to fight within the trade unions for women to be organised initially, just to get women in the unions. And even if you look now at the trade unions and who's at the top, it's mostly men, you know, pretty much. And probably won't have time to just go into say, you know, the reasons for that. But it's still a battle to get recognition in many cases, although most unions now have got very, very good policies on women. It's whether they carry them out or not is the issue. Whether or not, you know, they often pay lip service, if you like, and don't perhaps do it. And the last strike, of course, I'm sure I've only mentioned briefly, was the Match Girls, which was caused by, in the East End of London, by poor working conditions, 14-hour working days, very poor pay, excessive fines, and the severe health complications of working with matches, which meant phosphorus, which meant where your jaw pretty much crumbled by the end of it. The workers initiated that strike. 1,400 women and girls, again, mostly very young, 12, 13-year-old girls, got involved in that particular strike itself. And that was one as well, very famous strike here. So you can see that not only was the trade union movement starting to take off in general, but women also, because they've been sucked into industry under awful conditions, were fighting back. Of course, the other background, of course, as we know, was in fact the you know, the Russian Revolution, which has been mentioned as well, which I'll come on to in a minute. And so that, you know, in terms of the first wave then, was extremely important and gained for May. But the next wave, as people have mentioned, was the 60s and the 70s. And what happened during the Second World War, and I'm talking mostly about the West, of course, in America and Britain, women went into the workplace. They had to and all of a sudden realised that women could make aeroplanes, unfortunately bombs as well, all sorts of things, could keep industry going. Post-Second World War, it was back into the home. You've got to build up the next generation. It's the men coming back from the war that have to have the jobs. This is where the next sort of wave came from. The backdrop in the US, where I think it probably was more initiated from than anything else in America, was the civil rights movement. You know, the rights for blacks in America drew in a feeling of women, not just black women, but all women, that actually we're oppressed as well and we want to do something. And of course, if you were to ask people what was the 60s and 70s like, they'd end, obviously I'm old enough to remember some of it. It was, well, they're all burning their bras, aren't they? And having big bonfires, they'll throw their bras on the burn. And then, although that went on in some cases, it wasn't really what it was. But again, you can see even the media then were trying to give the impression of mad women, you know, just crazy, and ordinary women aren't going to want anything to do with them. So that was the backdrop, part of that. And if you look at some of the people that wrote at that particular time about those conditions, and what women were doing. You had women like Simone Beauvoir, who wrote the Beauvoir, I think it's pronounced, who wrote The Second Sex. And I think there was a lot of looking at women, you know, in terms of some of it navel-gazing, I suppose, from the privilege perhaps of being at, you know, university, have lots of time to look into it. But it nevertheless was the case, you know, Simone de Beauvoir called it the second sex, because she said the normative, or you like, the Norman, the human, when people talk about human being, they tend to mean a man, and a woman is the other, and she described woman as the other person, or the other individual, but was always, you know, lower down, if you like. And there was also Betty Friedan that wrote in America. She wrote the famous book, Feminine Mystique. What was she saying about post-war? You had a lot of American college-educated women who, once they got their education, got married, got a nice house, middle-class ones, had children, and were told, this is your life. This is the ultimate. This is the peak of your life. There is nothing else. And who also were being pressurised by capitalism at the time, trying to build up after the Second World War, with buying everything. You've got to make your home wonderful with washing machines, fridges and everything, and we just want you as consumers. And there was a lot of, you know, anger about that eventually, when women were saying, we want more than this. We don't just want to sit in our house all day. We want to take part in society. Then, of course, you had struggles here in the 60s and that 70s for equal pay. The most famous, of course, being the Ford worker strike that took place in 1968 for equal pay. And those women who made car seats for cars, you know, for the cars, in terms of doing, you know, a lot of stitching, sewing machine work. They used to repair their sewing machines as well. It was quite a dangerous job, the sort of machines they used. But in those days, you had a women's rate. And this came from the idea that women only needed what was known as pin money. You know, just, you know, you're just going out for a little bit extra to buy your makeup at the weekend. The man will provide all of that, and therefore there's the feeling that women didn't have to work. But they interviewed a lot of the Ford workers a little while ago. TVC got quite a good, you know, series of videos and that, talking to them. And as one said, I was a single parent, so that was very rare in those days. And on a Monday morning, I'd take my child across to my mother in the next town, and I'd work in the factory all week and come back and pick my child up for the weekend. And therefore, for her, that was, she had to have the money, but the others there were sort of supplemented and that. But that was a magnificent struggle. They came out on strike. Because the car seats weren't stitched, there was no car production at that particular site. By the end of the dispute, the men had walked out on other sites as well, and all the Ford car production in Britain stopped, and it was the biggest exporter at the time. If you like, they won. They won their case. Some of the demands they won some years later, as is always the case. But nevertheless, that was a victory. And all the stuff about Barbara Castle brought in, you know, the Equal Pay Act and Anti-Discrimination Act and what have you. She wouldn't have done that because it provoked other struggles. It provoked other strikes where women wanted equal pay and actually started to achieve it. And to cut across that, the Labour government, with Castle at the time as the minister there, actually brought in the act to say, no, women have to be paid equal pay. And as, you know, people here have said, the way they get around that now is, if you look at what jobs women do, they're low paid, they're part-time, then you look at what jobs women, and as Eleanor has said, that women and men generally in similar type work seem to be on the same sort of money until, you know, children of the family come along, and that's when women are mostly discriminated against. So that was the second waiver, if you like. But I think what's important to say, the backdrop was massive action, you know, in terms of huge strikes taking place. Perhaps not always enough women involved in those, but nevertheless there was a background of struggle. You had 68 in terms of the in France and what have you. And so it appears, when you look at it, that the backdrop to a lot of the struggles for women's equality comes from a general fight back against the capitalist system, not, you know, not even consciously against the capitalist system, but against wrongs and what have you. And finally, you know, just to finish, is this question of post-feminism. And I think, you know, the discussion today has shown that there's has been many gains made for women in society in that particular period, and a feeling that, you know, women have got it all now. They don't need anything else, and a question of individuality. Well, I've done all right, you know, I'm strong and, you know, upright, and I'm that sort of a woman. Other women are a bit weak if they can't get the job I've managed to get, etc. And many women would say, or definitely would have done in the 90s, that feminism's not for me. You know, this idea that feminism means, you know, not having any, you know, being a woman at all, and all the rest of it. And even a lot of the films, like, you know, one that's quoted a lot is Bridget Jones' Diary, where she's the independent, free, liberated woman, but her aim in life has to be to get a man. Yeah. You know, that always gets quite handsome. And that always has to be the sort of the element, and that in the films themselves. And even the idea that Thatcher did a favour for feminism, you know, because at last you had a woman prime minister. If ever there's a fact that, you know, any woman can, you know, achieve things for other women is rubbish. But that, again, wasn't against the background of an upturn in the workers' a movement and general struggle. That was against, really, the shifting away from the ideas of socialism because of the collapse of Stalinism itself. And, you know, we have seen things. I mean, obviously, it's something we might have a chance later on to debate, this question of, is the fact that there are more lap dancing clubs now, and the fact that a lot of universities now having beauty contests and what, is that a step backward? You know, I think we've got to be careful how we view it. But if it gives the impression, I mean, they're talking now about girls of 7 and 8 who say I'm fat or I'm not pretty enough or whatever. And if the culmination of that is to, you know, make women feel that the best talents they can possibly have is to look good or look good for men all the time, then that's something that can be dangerous. And of course, you have people like Germaine Greer, who back in the 60s was a bit more, slightly more militant, but in this period were saying things like that women were colluding in their own oppression, i.e., you know, it's your fault, you know, you just sit there and take it, well, you should fight back. And there's someone like Germaine Greer's never been poor, you know, she's all now probably must be a millionaire with all the books she's written. You probably can't understand what it's like to be an ordinary woman. And of course, the crisis of the male was a big thing, and probably still is. And someone just mentioned the grades that young women were getting in terms of at school and GCSEs, A levels, and then on in university, more than men. I don't know the latest statistics, you know, what they are, mostly with the lack of manufacturing jobs and the idea, which is said, that men tend, if you ask a man what you do, you know, what you do with your life, they're more likely to associate with their job. I work here, I work there, where they say women are more likely to say, well, I've got 2 children or what have you. I don't think that's, you know, cut and dried in any way, but nevertheless, they're saying there was a lack of identity, and all these strong, you know, women were really ruining their lives, and they didn't know which direction to turn. And I mean, I think we have to make it clear, you know, we obviously are not, you know, men haters or anything like that at all, and that the ruling class will use ways to divide society, whether it's black and white or immigration or not or whatever, or men and women. You know, they will try and make divisions, and if it's only by standing together, and men and women standing together and fighting back, that it can actually be stopped. So that's really just a sort of a short background, as I say, ending with sort of post-feminism. And I think we've already discussed it a little bit already as to whether or not, is that era coming to an end? Is there the beginnings of somewhat of a, not necessarily a fight back, but a bit more awareness of the oppression of women now, or are we still in a sort of a post-feminist environment? So.
Okay, so
the possibility of there being true equality between men and women, so that it would take time. And that isn't just an issue on equality for women or to stop women's oppression. That's also on a whole range of issues where if you've been brought up in a society, and we accept that has a huge impact on how you're brought up, that generation perhaps is not going to be able to fully change, have hang-ups, if you like, which I think one of the speakers said, from the past period. And if you look at the Russian Revolution and women themselves, even prior to the revolution, then, you know, Lenin in particular wrote a lot on women and encouraged women a lot to join the Bolshevik Party, to get involved in the revolution itself. And Krupskaya, which was his wife, but also a fellow comrade as well, that played a big role. Just a brief quote to read out about something she wrote about Lenin after his death, and said that the emancipation of women is inseparably bound up with the entire struggle for the workers' cause, for socialism. Lenin paid special attention to the position of women, workers and peasants, and to drawing them into the working class movement. And she said that women took a very active part in the civil war itself, which obviously took place after the invasion from the West to try and overthrow the revolution. The civil war that took place, said that many women played an active role in that as soldiers and what have you, and many died in the action itself. And some of the gains from the revolution is that once, you know, the revolution that happened and the workers were in control, then some of the things they won, first of all, they won the right to divorce on request, which we haven't got now. You know, someone has to blame the other person as to why you have to wait, I don't know how many years it is now, two or three, what have you. Two people don't want to live, so if one person doesn't want to live with another person, that should be it. Very, very simple marriage. No one was forced to marry, but a very simple marriage, civil marriage, which, you know, was fairly straightforward. Legal, free abortions. Mm. There's a question about whether even that's, we've got that now, because, you know, it might be okay to say you can get an abortion on the NHS, but how long do you want to hang around for? You know, once you decide that you perhaps don't want that baby, then how long do you want to hang around for? A lot of women go private in order to get an abortion within a reasonable amount of time. So. Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So it's not, that's right, two doctors have to decide.
Yeah, male doctors.
And plus the fact, of course, that it's 24 weeks when it was 28 weeks was the limit. That's been reduced, and of course we saw last year big battles of certain people on the right to try and reduce it even further. Homosexuality was legalised. I mean, that's incredible when we're talking about 1917, 1918, after the Russian Revolution itself. Equal pay was introduced, and equal rights, maternity leave, communal services. I think it's been, you know, pointed out that, you know, if you've got, if you're going to, you know, women and men are going to be equal, then a lot of the chores and that have got to be taken out of the home. I mean, Lenin spoke particularly about some of the peasant women and the drudgery of working in the home from, you know, and it happens in many parts of the world today where hours and hours are spent walking miles and miles to get some water and bring it back, trying to make meals out of very little food. And, you know, their whole lives, their whole days, weeks and lives are just spent in absolute drudgery. And he made the point, you know, these women have got to be helped out of this, you know, and shown that there's another sort of a life. Now, this was undermined, of course, under Stalinism. A lot of the meetings taking place this weekend are on the basis of the collapse of Stalinism, but the rise of Stalinism. Then, obviously, things started to go back. There was a feeling that there had to be more children in order to bring, you know, Russia up to a higher, Soviet Union up to a higher level. And women were really pushed back into the home. Abortion became illegal in most cases as well. And you can see there, you know, the whole backwardness, if you like. And also there's an element in Russia, in the Soviet Union, of this praising women, that women are marvellous, their fertility, the way they produce children, they should be honoured, you know. And really what that was saying, back into the home, have lots of kids and stay out of the way. And that, there was an element of that in Nazi Germany as well. This idea in Nazi Germany was, of course, developed the race, you know, the Aryan race, and that means women have to go back and have plenty of children. So even in societies where women are praised, it's often for the wrong completely the wrong reasons themselves. And if you look, you know, just briefly at our record, and I'll be quite brief, and some of the things we've done as the Socialist Party, and before that the Militant, then obviously we set up the Campaign Against Domestic Violence campaign and really raised awareness. We put stalls up in town centres where women would come up to us and say, I'm abused, I've been suffering domestic violence for 10, 20 years and I've never had the courage to come up, because we'd have big banners saying domestic violence is wrong, we oppose domestic violence. But more than that, that's not only that, is that we took the issue into the trade unions and made sure that a large number of trade unions developed policies to help female trade union members. What do you do if there's domestic violence? If you're at work, you're going to need time off. You might have to transfer and live somewhere else, etc. And also campaigning, you know, against the court judgments, which unfortunately still go on today, where very often, you know, men can say, well, I murdered her because the dinner was cold or she's been nagging me lately. Yeah. But a woman who murdered a husband, of course, found that, you know, even though she'd been abused for years and years and years, still ended up getting a sentence of murder. And that is at last is beginning to change somewhat. But that was helped on, without a doubt, by a lot of the campaigning that we did in that particular campaign, but also seeing that we needed to get into the trade unions themselves and getting those policies agreed by the unions. And it's very important. I mean, one side issue on that is quite interesting. Once you get into a big campaign like that, is we had a lot of opposition from what is now Refuge, which used to be Women's Aid, on the basis that they felt that these women's jobs in the women's industry were theirs by birth almost, and were convinced that we were trying to get in on their game, when in fact, you know, nobody in the campaign against domestic violence was looking for a job. We were, it was a campaign within the you know, the many Socialist Party members, but others as well, were involved in, and it did show this sort of tight-knit sort of groups that there sometimes can be, and that's not, you know, overall, because a lot of these organisations do a lot of good work. Of course, last year we had a lot of campaigning on abortion rights, and the very first meeting that we went to on abortion rights in the Houses of Parliament, along with, you know, many other women, loads and loads of MPs, rows of them, just had to listen to them for ages. The first thing we raised in that meeting is that lobbying Parliament was not enough, that we called for a mass demonstration organised by the trade union movements and the abortion rights campaign, get out onto the streets and show other women that they're not alone, that, you know, and other men as well, to show, to unite, to say, you know, abortion's not wrong, we don't want the limit to go back, and raise the profile, make women feel that it's not just me, other people think the same way I do. That was never taken up. And the other thing we pushed for wasn't just defending the abortion rights at the moment, but extending them as well, which is something, again, that they finally did take up, but after we'd given out a lot of leaflets saying defend and extend abortion rights, because points already been made about the question of the two doctors, the question about the limitations on the NHS, of abortion, etc., and you know, many other rights, and a deal was done behind closed doors, we know, to stop that there was beginning to be a momentum building up for Northern Ireland to have the same abortion rights as England, Wales and Scotland, which they still haven't got, and deals were done with the Ulster unions in order to get a vote through Parliament, and the concession was, we won't, you know, we won't let this come into Parliament, we won't push it. So the wheeling and dealing that goes on in the normal times of government, but it was a a good campaign to have, and it did show that there is a layer of women, particularly young women, that were extremely angry, and you sort of felt, is this the beginning of a bit of a fight back now in terms of some of these issues affecting women? And I think the potential is actually there. And just to say as well about what we do in between is that we call ourselves, in terms of a better name, sort of Socialist Women, and we try and organise at least one or two meetings each year, where we can actually discuss key issues, which we then put to the parties in terms of, you know, having a particular policy on different issues, and they're very, you know, often very productive meetings, and we can try and work out what campaigns to perhaps be involved with and what leaflets to put out and etc. So I suppose that's really a little taste, if you like, of what happened straight after the Russian Revolution. The reason, of course, things went backward is that Russia was at an economic level so far behind many of the other countries in the world, and although it caught up in a large extent because of a planned economy, it was quite brutal. And of course, you know, without a high level of technology and a high level of you know, capitalist production before going over into socialism, then it was very, very difficult and easy, if you like, for there to be a lot of problems. And the main reason, of course, is that Lenin and Trotsky always pointed out you can't have a revolution in one country. If the Russian Revolution had spread to advanced countries like Germany, advanced countries like France, Britain, the US, then that would have immediately, those countries would have come to the aid of the United, of the Soviet Union themselves to make sure that that the country did proceed. But isolated and on their own, the revolution obviously went backwards. So there was a glimpse there of what would happen under a socialist government, what could be implemented. And even then, Lenin, Trotsky, the other leaders of the revolution, the other sort of women involved as well, knew, you know, that without raising the living standards, and without having democracy in the country, then these marvellous rights that were given to women wouldn't be able to stay, and tragically, you know, that they've gone backward. But nevertheless, we've still got a lot to learn from what happened in the revolution itself and post-revolution, and a sort of a bit of a beacon, if you like, into what could be introduced under a socialist society.
Right, thanks, Jane.